John Glazer. My guest today is Robert E. Kelly, professor of political science at Pusan University in South Korea. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I want to start the conversation out by reviewing what happened to U.S. policy towards North and South Korea during the Trump administration. You wrote a paper about this, describing the persistent status quo with North Korea, that though the Trump administration swung wildly from hawkish to dovish, we didn't see any real change in results. Can you explain why the status quo in North Korea is so persistent?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I mean, the observation I often have when I sort of read stuff about North Korea, you know, they have like subtitles like sort of like a peninsula in transition or sort of Korea in transition. And I think we sort of default to speak in that kind of way because we want to make things sound like they're new or they're interesting. You know, we're entering a new era and that kind of talk. That kind of language is sort of very common, particularly in journalism. And I often find actually when I, in reading about North Korea, is actually, what often strikes me is how North Korea doesn't change. How North Korea actually isn't really turning a corner or entering a new era or doing things that actually the North Korea, my sense is, you know, that North Korea is pretty much governed the same way it has been really for decades, arguably, I think, since the 1960s. I mean, others have written about this and know North Korea's domestic politics better than I do. But I mean, North Korean foreign policy, I think, hasn't really wavered too much or hasn't really changed too much. I think the status quo, now to get more specifically to why the peninsula status quo is pretty sunk in, I think both sides have accustomed themselves and accommodated themselves to it. I mean, it's now been, 75 years since 1945 that the division, 77 years, right? The division has been in place. The two states have really sort of grown distinctly and the long, you know, into sort of distinct entities. Obviously, there's a sort of shared cultural substrate, but politically and militarily and increasingly socially, they are becoming distinct. You can see that in sort of South Korean polling about North Korea, where increasingly South Koreans see North Korea as like a separate country. And this is sort of, and we have sort of some experience with this in the case of Germany, for example, where East and West Germany were in fact beginning to significantly grow apart. And I've often thought that the Germans kind of got lucky that German unification happened when it did, because there were enough older Germans still alive, West Germans still alive, that they were able to, that there was enough sort of hangover of national unity to sort of push for unification when the window opened in the late 80s. And I wonder if that's going to be the case in Korea, where the division continues to sort of, you know, go on and on and on. At some point, the two sides are just going to grow really apart and see one another as distinct states. And so I think the political division is pretty deeply rooted. It's been there for 77 years now. That difference is being reinforced by other differences, most obviously social, that the two populations are growing up differently with different expectations about what government does and different expectations about how they lead their lives and, you know, how they economically interact with one another and things like that. And I think that it's hard, I think, to overcome that increasing separation. So more specifically, politically, I think, is that North Korea doesn't really want to change a great deal, that the North Korean elite is actually pretty comfortable with the status quo. I do not actually believe in the language of IR theory, of international relations theory, I do not actually believe that North Korea is a revisionist state anymore, even though it is formally and technically, both sides are sort of formally constitutionally revisionist states, which is to say they make claims against the other. But in fact, the status quo, I think, works for both sides relatively well. At least on the North Korean side, it works for regime elites very well. And then I think for South Koreans, again, I think they just sort of accustomed themselves to it. And so you're sort of colliding with decades and decades of entrenched division where, you know, major groups inside society have configured themselves around this, and it makes it harder and harder to change. And Trump really sort of collided with that. And so did Moon Jae-in. I think they just sort of collided with these longstanding interests that, you know, really don't actually want change unless it's sort of understood as sort of surrender or something like that, right? I mean, South Korea would like change if North Korea surrenders, but that's not going to happen. Same thing, you know, on the North Korean side. And so I think the division is just sort of, it's sunk in. It's granulating down into both societies to the point where really big breakthrough changes are very, very difficult. This is why in my writing, I've argued for a long time that we should not be shooting for a big bang deal between the two Koreas. It's just too difficult. There's no Nixon goes to China moment, I think, waiting in the wings. There's no Camp David moment waiting in the wings where you can bring two enemies that have been, apart for a while and reconcile them with some kind of big breakthrough diplomacy. I just do not believe that is possible in the Korean case. I think the differences that we've discussed here are just too sunk in. And instead, I think I've argued for a long time we should go for small deals, right? Sort of like little piecemeal things. The North Koreans give us like a warhead and we give them a sanctions rollback or a pile of money or something. I don't know. I mean, we can get into that, but I've argued for a long time that that just a big bang deal is just beyond. It's a bridge too far, because the status quo is so deeply set.
Can you talk a little bit before I pull on some of those threads? Can you describe how you see the Trump administration's various overtures towards North Korea? I mean, first it was fire and fury and really kind of unprecedented threats, and then it was excessive, what you might call dovishness. I mean, of a sort, certain it was certainly not a concentrated strategy. But what did North Korea kind of learn from this? Can you kind of go through that and tell us how it ended up?
Yeah, so I actually, in my writing, I think with one of my graduate students, I wrote an article in which I argued that I called the Trump administrational operational doves, I think is the term I used. I wrote that like 3 or 4 years ago. And the argument was sort of what you're saying, right? Which is that I don't think anybody really thinks that Donald Trump is a dove, right? And that doesn't sort of strike anybody as think it's a normal interpretation of the guy. But in practice, when it actually came to dealing with North Korea, he was in fact more dovish in policy and actual in operation than really any previous US president, which is to say that he was willing to meet with the North Korean supreme leader, which is something no other American president had ever done. And he looked, at least he signaled for a while in his rhetoric that he was willing to make concessions or seemed to be willing to make concessions. Again, it's hard to know because Trump was so erratic. Okay, and so and so all, I mean, erratic, I suppose, is the word that I would primarily use to define the Trump administration. I mean, I was pretty critical of the Trump outreach. My sense, and honestly, my sense, to be very blunt, I think Trump was really doing it for domestic politics. I genuinely believe that Trump was doing this because he saw this as a possible win, right? We know Trump's like wins the perception that he did something sort of amazing. I think that Trump was sort of very jealous that Barack Obama got a Nobel Prize and Barack Obama made fun of him at that press dinner or something or other like that. And he really sort of disliked Obama, he really loathed him. And Obama had a Nobel Prize. So he had that Nobel Prize too to prove that he was better than Obama and he could go and get one in Korea. And I think a lot of it, honestly, I think a lot of the effort was driven by Trump and his own sort of personal interest in sort of prestige and validation and approval by the press corps and things like that. And if you actually look at his press conferences after the three summits with Kim Jong-un, he spends lots of time talking about how the press is going to write about it and not a whole lot of time talking about the strategic issues. And so I think that was actually one of the reasons why it didn't work. I think Trump came into it for all the wrong reasons and it undercut his efforts repeatedly. If you look at the press conferences, it's pretty clear that Trump often didn't really sort of understand the issues. If you listen to his speeches back in the day, he was often sort of confused about like what exactly nuclear weapons were and how ballistic missiles worked and stuff like that. I mean, he just didn't really spend a lot of time on this. And if you compare that to say like Nixon and Kissinger working on China or Jimmy Carter working on the Camp David Accords or Bill Clinton working on the Camp David effort again in 2000, if that effort failed, be sure. But if you look at those three as sort of examples of kind of big breakthrough deal for which Trump, I think, was shooting, I think those were sort of arguably the models to the extent Trump had a model in mind at all. I mean, one of the things is that there was a major bureaucratic process behind that. The president himself was personally involved. The president steered the bureaucracy. The president actually read about these things. I mean, it's pretty clear that Nixon and Kissinger like knew a lot about China. And they like, I don't know specifically, but I imagine they actually read histories of China and then Jimmy Carter did the same thing. I mean, they put an effort into it. I mean, even Bill Clinton did. It's pretty clear that Bill Clinton put a lot of effort in. It didn't work, but there was a process there. And I think that's really what undercut Trump is it was just so half-assed. I mean, it was just so flying by the seat of your pants. I mean, we know from John Bolton's book that Trump didn't prepare for his first meeting in Singapore. I mean, he literally just got on the plane, flew into Singapore, got off, and like, I'm here, dude. Let's talk about, it's like his sort of like New York, Manhattan socialite. I'm gonna be on the front page of the New York Post kind of shtick. Hey man, and you can do that back home, I guess, in the New York socialite world. I mean, I don't know anything about that, but I mean that guy, I guess that shtick worked for Trump for a while, but I mean that's just not gonna work in diplomacy. And it was really clear, I think, with the big buildup to the summit back in, I think it was in June 2018. For 3 or 4 months there was this big buildup and I was being invited to go on TV shows and they're like, is Donald Trump gonna win Nobel one Nobel Prize or two? The second one was going to be for Iran. You know, are we going to like withdraw from the Korean Peninsula by the end of the year because Trump is going to make peace? I mean, there's this enormous talk up, this big sort of buildup that we're like on the cusp of this major breakthrough. And then if you actually look at the deal that Trump got out of Kim Jong-un in July and in June of that year is basically like a nothing burger. I mean, basically nothing changed. And I think the whole mess really speaks more to Trump and his failures, quite honestly, to be as a statesman, his inability to discipline himself, his inability to focus, his inability to manage the policy process, right? His inability to control his feuding subordinates. It's very clear, for example, that Pompeo and Bolton didn't want the deal. It's very clear. So we also know that his family was actually, Ivanka and Jared were nervous about Trump doing this. They thought he was going to get taken for a ride. And so I think Trump just wasn't able to sort of like bring a coherent White House policy process, much less reach out to the wider community, Congress, the Defense Department, the analyst community. You know, Trump was never really able to bring those people on board. And so I think this is why ultimately the engagement with North Korea sort of failed, because there was Trump at the top as POTUS, and he's obviously a super important actor in American foreign policy. But everything else wasn't there. There was no sort of buildup. There was no kind of support for this larger process. So when Trump himself got annoyed with it and bored with it and dropped it in, I think, late 2019, after the third summit, the one at the DMZ, the whole thing just collapsed because there was no bureaucratic support. There was no momentum behind it at all, right? The military was very wary about it. The State Department was like, we don't really know either. The analyst community came out quite harshly behind it because, you know, a lot of people like me, I mean, people way more important than me, were all like, you know, Trump, it's just like, you know, it's just kind of silly. He doesn't know what he's doing. I think Victor Cha called it like drive-by diplomacy. You know, Trump just got off the plane and whatever. And so, Congress was very, very nervous about this. Right. And so there was just no real support for this, ironically, other than here in South Korea from the South Korean left. That's actually a point a lot of people don't actually know. South Korean progressives actually like Donald Trump because he was willing to meet with Kim Jong-un. But South Korean conservatives were also very concerned that Trump was going to like give away the farm and stuff. And I think that's ultimately why it collapsed. Right. The status quo is very deeply sunk. Right. You've got powerful groups on both sides that have accommodated themselves to the division and are thriving or working with it and are nervous about big, big changes. And Trump came in and just didn't put in the work, quite honestly. He just wasn't serious enough about it. I do think that a more serious American statement would actually be able to sort of make a deal with North Korea. I do continue to believe that a deal is possible, but it would take someone like Obama or Bill Clinton, someone who genuinely believes in diplomacy, which is a real problem on the American right. You know, the American right today, I think, doesn't really believe in diplomacy that much anymore. Right. So it probably have to be a Democrat. And it would take someone who really actually put in the work. And again, I think the hope has always been on the South Korean left that you'd have like a big summit between the North Koreans and the Americans. And that would be like this breakthrough moment. The South Korean left has sort of banked on that idea for about 30 years. But they always envisioned it to be someone like Obama, you know, someone who really was sort of like a peacemaker and was like interested in substantive issues and wanted this for itself rather than Trump, who was sort of erratic and was, I think, pretty obviously doing it, quite honestly, just for the vainglory. I think he wanted a Nobel so he could sort of wave it in the air and say, I got it and I'm great and you love me because, you know, I made peace and you should reelect me. And I think once he began to see there was actually really work to get a deal in North Korea, he's like, oh, it's too much effort. You know, Trump was kind of lazy, right? You know, executive time, he's watching TV every morning in the White House until noon. And he just dropped it once he realized how hard it was.
You mentioned something that I do want to follow up on, because at the beginning you said, you know, you tend to talk about smaller deals and put aside the idea of a big grand bargain that would solve everything. But as you said, you know, if there were a president, say, that was serious and approached this in a serious way, and if you had the luck of a South Korean president from the left to make that approach all cohesive, I wonder if I can impose upon you to give us a sense of what you think a constructive framework for compromise and mutual accommodation would be if we were kind of aiming for that grand deal.
Yeah, so this has been an idea, the idea of like a summit to break through that entrenched status quo, the idea of a summit to break through that has been a particular idea on the South Korean left going back to at least the 1990s. Right. One of the reasons why the status quo is entrenched is that the South Korean right is comfortable with it, which is to say the South Korean right wants Southern-led unification and they want North Korea to collapse in the same way East Germany did. Right. The South Korean left is more ambiguous. Right. The South Korean left is more willing to say North Korea is a sort of brother Korean state. They're like us. They sort of lost their way under totalitarianism and the Cold War and American pressure and the bombing, particularly the US bombing of North Korea is often referenced as a reason why North Korea has slid into Orwellianism. And so the argument is, and we can sort of like reach out to North Korea and bring them in from the cold, right? That isolating them, deterring them, containing them, chasing them around, chasing the money around in banks and stuff like that, and chasing their diplomats all over the place, all over the world, that this is counterproductive and it just makes North Korea more and more paranoid and more hostile. I don't know if I buy that entirely, but I'm willing to sort of, I kind of get it. And so I think the policy argument emanate from this, from this argument made again, mostly by the South Korean left. You don't hear this in the Western analyst community much, but mostly here. The argument is that the status quo is too sunk in, right? It's too ossified, it's too sclerotic, right? And what we need is a sort of Alexandrine sort of strike to, cut the Gordian knot in one clean stroke, right? And the Gordian knot there, the sword there. The Alexandrine sword is going to be a summit of the leaders, particularly the leaders of North Korea and South Korea, right? And that is why there was so much excitement here about Trump, and there was so much support for it. And this is why Moon Jae-in was like, I mean, literally, Moon Jae-in was like whispering to Trump's ear, oh, if you do this, you're going to get a Nobel Prize. It'll be this great statesman. I mean, it was kind of an open secret here in South Korea that Moon was flattering Trump, and he's like the Trump whisperer, stuff like that. And in the US, people were like, oh, Trump is going to do this breakthrough and he's going to get a Nobel Prize. Nobody here in Korea, I think, actually really believed that. I think it was the sense instead is that, we can get a breakthrough in North Korea, and if we have to butter Trump up and flim-flam him and con him into thinking that he's Gandhi or Martin Luther King or something, we'll do that in order to get the guy in the room. And it worked. They got him in the room. But Trump didn't prepare, and so I think that's one of the reasons why it all kind of fell apart. So what would it look like if it was like Obama? If it was Bill Clinton, if you actually had sort of like a major summit in which you had an American president who prepared, I think there are a couple of things. The most important thing is there would have to be some kind of discussion about nuclear weapons, right? The North Koreans would have to move at least somewhat on nuclear weapons, and the Americans would have to make some pretty major concessions on that. One of the reasons why we're not talking to North Koreans at all right now is because the North Koreans have increasingly become unwilling to discuss nuclear weapons or missiles really at all. Now, I agree with Jeffrey Lewis and some of these others who said this. I said this on CNN the other day, that we're probably going to have to learn to live with North Korea as a nuclear weapon state. I mean, in practice, we already have, right? I mean, North Korea's been a nuclear weapon state since 2016, and they've been able to strike CONUS, the continental United States, since 2017. And we have not, in fact, bombed North Korea or done any of these things. We keep saying, North Korea with nuclear ICBMs is intolerable, but we have, in fact, learned to live with it now for the last 5 years. And so there's an argument that we can make that concession, we can formally make that concession. You are, in fact, a nuclear weapon state, right? But that would require some kind of counter concession from North Korea. That would require some kind that we would have to get something back for that. This is my concern about Jeffrey Lewis's argument in the New York Times the other day. Okay, if we're gonna, my argument always is if we're gonna do this kind of stuff, if we're gonna give up sanctions, we gotta get something. If we're gonna give up nuclear weapon status, we're gonna accept that, we should get something. If we're gonna formally recognize North Korea and have like consulates and an embassy, then we should get something in exchange for it, right? I mean, we should do deals and swaps, and it should be in the language, again, sort of to think of IR here, in the language of Kohain, it should not be diffuse reciprocity because there's not enough strategic trust. So it's gotta be specific reciprocity. It's gotta be point for point, A for B, and it's got to be very clearly written out in long, long sentences, in long, long documents where we can go through and like check every single individual point. And if we can do that and the stakes are small, right? Again, sort of IR here, right? Functionalism, right? We can sort of build slowly towards bigger deals. And that, I think, is where a dedicated American leader could really do a breakthrough, right? He could actually sit in the room with the North Koreans, and maybe because it's summit, it's leader to leader, that initial small deal could maybe be a little bit bigger than might otherwise be. I do think that even a summit with someone like Obama makes a big bang deal impossible. I think a big bang deal is beyond our ability, but I do think that a summit could probably get a little bit more than what you might get from diplomats meeting around the UN. The North Koreans want the reason I make that argument is because we know the North Koreans want the prestige of meeting POTUS. And this is something that the North Koreans have wanted for a while, right? That was one of the reasons why a lot of hawks, including me, were very sort of nervous about Trump going to meet North Korea without any concessions, because I would argue that the prestige of meeting an American president 3 times as a tin pot dictator, I mean, the North Koreans are like the most Orwellian, awful regime on the planet. So if they get to meet POTUS, we ought to get something for it. And Trump didn't do that. I think, and I would argue that was an error. So I think a more dedicated American president could sort of make the argument to the U.S. public, right, which Trump really never did. Trump's speeches about North Korea were very erratic and bizarre. Trump could make a pitch to Congress. He'd actually get up and give like a speech to Congress and say, you know, here's this country, which we have understood as an enemy for all these years, but now we need to rethink our foreign policy towards them. And here's my plan. And, you know, we're going to reach out to North Koreans and make a series of sort of swaps and deals. Trump could try to reach, an Obama figure could reach out to, the analyst community, to the State Department, to the chunks of the bureaucracy, you know, state defense and stuff, the intelligence community that would be very nervous about that. These are all things Trump didn't do. Right. There's, again, I've if you read my stuff in preparation for this, we talked about this. All this is in there. I mean, I've been making these kinds of arguments for a while that Trump failed because he built no coalition. Curiously enough, Trump was reliant on the South Korean left here. That was really the only public support he had. And it just didn't work at home, where he was just criticized relentlessly in the media. And so any kind of Obama figure would have to do that. He would have to sort of show up, be ready to go, have some kind of specific deals and some ability to sort of like swap and trade, right? One reason why the Hanoi deal fell apart was because Trump didn't actually know very much about what was going on. So once the North Koreans rejected it, Trump didn't really understand enough of what the stakes were to actually get into a back and forth and a tit for tat bargain. That's one of the reasons why Pompeo and Bolton were able to undercut him, because Trump didn't understand enough of the issues much well enough to push back on his own staff. Was very, a lot of his staff was very hawkish and didn't want to deal at all. And Trump also didn't know enough to engage Kim Jong-un personally over the table. Instead, just, you know, Trump threw a tantrum and literally stormed out of the room. I mean, that was our big chance for a breakthrough. Kim actually brought a deal to the table. It was a terrible deal, by the way, but he did bring something. Trump also brought a deal, which was also terrible, but at least they were both there. And that was the big moment, and Trump completely blew it because he just wasn't, you know, ready either to deal with his own, you know, on his own side of the table, with his own opponents on his own side of the table, and with the, to really engage in back and forth with the North Koreans. I guarantee you Kim Jong-un was far, far better prepared for that meeting than Trump. So that's what, those are the elements, I think, of a kind of Nixon goes to China kind of moment. Trump would come in, you know, the figure would come, Obama or whatever, I know, Biden, whoever it might be, would come in really ready to go with a lot of good information, would have groomed some kind of domestic coalition, or at least laid some kind of groundwork for a deal, so you're not just sort of like pulling it out of a hat, right? And then also working with, you know, we'd have to work with partners over here too, which is something we haven't discussed at all. But I mean, Trump really alienated the South Koreans by going on TV and like attacking them. And I mean, Trump has said that like Moon Jae-in was like horrible, President Moon Jae-in, and he wants to blow up the alliance and stuff like that. And so, you know, I mean, Trump doesn't have a lot of sympathy out here in Korea among the relevant national security communities, right? There's a lot of anxiety that Trump wants to abandon South Korea. And so, I think, you know, there's a lot of groundwork that a more serious president would do. But I think if that was done, then a more serious president might actually be able to make some concessions that will be hard for our side to swallow. Accepting North Korea as a nuclear weapon state, giving up some sanctions, letting North Korea into international financial institutions. That's an idea that you hear floated around as a concession. Letting North Korea into the IMF or the World Bank so they actually borrow at below market interest rates for internal development. Okay, maybe. Might work if they would be willing to pay it back. Probably wouldn't, though. They'd probably cheat. So, I mean, you know, but we can, you know, I mean, but, so making those concessions, you're going to have to say, you're going to have to pitch that stuff. You're going to have to sell that stuff to the hawks back home, you know, to the generals and to the analysts. And a more serious politician, I think, might be able to convincingly argue to opponents back home, I can get real stuff out of the North Koreans. And he could actually bring a list of, here are the things the North Koreans are going to give us. They're going to give us like 5 nuclear warheads. So we can cut them open and look at what they have. Or they're going to like give us, you know, like a third of their TELs, their transporter vector launchers. Again, I don't know what it might be, but that I think is what a more mature summit might have actually captured us.
You wrote in a co-authored paper that North Korea's the failure of that approach, basically the failure of Trump and Moon's dovish outreach, is likely to push the Overton window of acceptable counter North Korea policy options rightward. Can you explain why you think that? Because I can see it going both ways, actually.
So like I said, I think the left wing, the sort of left wing, particularly South Korean progressive, but also some Western analysts, the left wing sort of critique for a long time has been, you know, the hawkish approach to North Korea doesn't work. It's this ossified confrontation. It's just getting worse and worse. Everybody's arming, right? You know, have all these sort of like deeply entrenched interest groups, you know, hawkish analysts in the military and, you know, defense industrial complex and stuff like that, right? And they're all sort of like, you know, it's this sort of ossified, rigid, sort of frozen sort of standoff, and we need sort of like this big thing, right? And so we're going to have like the summit that's going to like radically change things. And that I think arguably, you know, Trump was sort of that guy, and certainly Moon Jae-in wanted to be that guy. It's very clear that Moon Jae-in had absorbed that narrative. I mean, that's where I'm getting this from, really, because you don't hear this in the West. This is really what you hear, what we heard during the Moon period. And that was going to be Moon Jae-in's big thing, right? He's going to really sort of like, there's going to be like a gestalt shift, right? We're going to like rethink the peninsula. Instead of North Korea being like a fearsome Orwellian tyranny, it would be understood as a developing country who needed our assistance or something like that. Okay, well, that I would argue that, I mean, that didn't work. I don't think Trump and Moon really got anything out of North Korea. I mean, empirically, there's been really no change on the peninsula at all. The North Koreans could have done some small stuff at the DMZ to signal sort of goodwill. They could have pulled back artillery, for example, which don't really need so much anymore because they have nuclear weapons, and they didn't do it. Okay. And so my thinking was, you know, for 30 years, progressives have told us this is the breakthrough moment, and we did it, and we had six summits. Moon met Kim three times. Trump met Kim three times for like 2 or 3 years there. We were talking about like peace on the peninsula, and we're in this new era and everything else. And Moon Jae-in released all this literature here in South Korea talking about himself as a peacemaker and Korea's going to be changed forever and all this. And really nothing came out of it. And my read was that hawks are going to see this and say, we told you, you sit down with the North Koreans and they're just not going to be serious about it. They're just going to gimmick these negotiations. The North Koreans are just going to take the prestige benefits from the meeting. They're going to take the pictures and go home. And so my thinking was that what this would do is it would damage the progressive argument that a big bang deal is possible at the summit level, and that would push the entire policy option debate to the right. Now, to a certain extent, that argument for the rightward shift of the Overton window is undercut by the fact that Trump was never serious about it, right? If Obama did it and it failed, I think there would be a much sharper move to the right. Okay, I think progressives can argue correctly that Trump was never serious. The whole thing was ridiculous anyway. Moon Jae-in was a good counterparty, but Trump was just, you know, Trump was just a clown, right? And so, you know, the idea of sort of like a summit-driven breakthrough, that policy option has not been disproven. That's kind of, and so anyway, so I thought, my sense was that because of that, that would sort of open further options. The option I was actually thinking of was that increasingly we might quarantine North Korea. I was actually thinking that we might actually, because sanctions enforcement is a big problem, and I've heard a little bit that this is actually something that we might start thinking about, right? Because we're worried about the inflow of weapons and parts and stuff like that. We've had a lot of trouble getting Russia and China to cooperate on sanctions. Trump and Moon promised us this big breakthrough and a Nobel Prize and everything else. Nothing came about it. Came out of it. North Korea looks incorrigible. So we have to start thinking about more aggressive options. And the thing that I had heard for a while there was sort of maybe we're going to do like a sort of like Cuban Missile style, crisis style quarantine or something like that. I think I was wrong. It seems to me that that was incorrect. Instead, I think you see this rightward Overton window shift in South Korea increasingly in the nuclear discussion, right? There is now increasingly a debate in South Korea about building their own nuclear weapons. And I think that is also a sort of conservative backlash to what happened with Moon and Trump. I have to say, I did not anticipate that South Korean opinion would be so supportive of nuclear weapons so rapidly. I thought it was going to be a little bit lower than that. You know, the new president, for example, talked about like airstrikes on North Korea. That's another example. I had kind of thought of quarantine because I actually think that might actually be directly useful in terms of cutting off North Korea's imports because we had so much trouble with sanctions enforcement. But anyway, all those are sort of like more conservative or hawkish options that, you know, like 5 years ago, nobody would have talked about. And I think those options those aren't great options, and there are a lot of problems with all of them. But all of those, I think, have been unlocked. They have greater legitimacy now than they did 5 years ago because of the perception that Trump and Moon blew it. So that's what I was thinking. And I think that I'm writing a paper right now, actually, in which I'm making this argument that North Korea had its chance with Trump and Moon and they blew it. And what this has done is this has incentivized South Korea to start building its own or start agitating to build its own nuclear weapons. That discussion, I've been living in Korea for 15 years. The discussion from South Korea's own indigenous nuclear weapons is more active in the last 8 months than all the other time I've been here. This is like amazing. Like, I just out of nowhere, this thing has just exploded. And I mean, I'm going to conferences on it. I've been to 2 conferences already on this, and I'm going to one in the fall. And I think this is a direct outcome of a direct response to the failure of 2018-19.
Stepping back from the peninsula per se, you recently co-authored a piece with Paul Post in Foreign Affairs, arguing that the data from the Trump years reinforces this idea that, as you guys put it, U.S. allies can be bullied. Can you explain that thesis?
Yeah, blame Paul for the language that's a little more aggressive. Don't blame me. But yeah, I mean that was I mean there was a, so there was a big sort of wave of writing in the longer version, the stuff that got cut away by the peer reviewers. The longer version actually had like all these quotations from guys in the authors in 2021 after Biden came in, and there was sort of a wave of this writing saying, you know, we have to reach out to the allies, we have to reassure them. You know, I think like Timothy Garton Ash wrote this kind of stuff. You know, and some other people, some other think tanker types and stuff, and some stuff on like War on the Rocks or whatever. I don't know. I could dig it all up. Anyway, but the idea was we have to sort of reassure the allies. You know, Trump was so terrible, and you know, we have to sort of, you know, tell them that we're back. You know, America's back, right? I think, you know, Biden himself used that expression. And what Paul and I both noticed was that a lot of this language was, I would argue, was sort of normative. Okay, it's like we want to sort of look like a good partner to the Europeans, but it's not really clear to me that this language of we need to do this, that American alliances are somehow on edge, that like NATO is about to collapse and stuff like that because Trump is so terrible, right? I would not argue that empirically there was actually much support for that thesis, right? That Trump kind of came in and yelled at American allies and sort of turned up the volume on the free riding debate. I mean, that's something American, you know, sec defs have been saying for 25 years, I suppose. But I mean, Trump really turned that up to 11, right? I mean, he came to South Korea and said, you got to quintuple your support or like we're leaving, right? And the South Koreans are like, oh my God, who is this guy? But Trump basically got away with that. Remember when he like, didn't he like print out like an Excel spreadsheet and give it to like Angela Merkel and be like, you owe us like $50 billion for NATO? He actually did that, right? And that kind of language provoked a big sort of backlash, you know, sort of in the liberal internationalist community and the European partners and stuff like that. You know, how could you do this? And you know, we're standing shoulder to shoulder and stuff like that. And but what's noticeable is that the European partners didn't really, you know, do much to soft balance or defect or drift or, you know, whatever language you want to use, right? And again, in the fuller version, and I'm hoping Paul and I can actually send it to an academic journal, which is will be much longer. The fuller version actually goes through. We actually like did like content analysis of like white papers from a lot of American allies. They basically found no change at all in the language during the Trump years. I mean, I think we had like one or two lines from like some French statement or something like that. But basically nothing from Chan, nothing from South Korea, nothing from Germany, and leader statements also were all like, you know, well, we need to find a way to get along with them, and you know, the European response to Trump was to flatter him. You know, European non-governmental elites, right, at like the European Council on Foreign Relations and stuff, they pushed back, right? The non-governmental discussion in Europe was, I mean, obviously, I mean, they're pretty upset with Trump, right, in the newspapers and stuff like that. But the actual governmental language was much more sort of accommodating, or just ignored him, right? And so that was kind of like a hard test of the willingness of American allies to sort of be hegemonically bullied, and would they quit? Would they defect? Now you could argue that one thing that they did was think, well, you know, it's only 4 years, we just sort of like buckle down and sort of hang on and just sort of ride out the storm and whatever. If Trump had been reelected, that would have been a better test, because then you would have had 8 years of Trump, and that would have given more space for a more sustained bureaucratic reaction. So to a certain extent, Paul and I are a little bit crippled by that, but I think if you look at the leader level statements, if you look at budgeting from a lot of America's allies, there's basically no, there's very little data to suggest that they were so shocked by Trump that they were considering other options. And so basically Trump was able to get away with abusing them and at almost no cost. And that's pretty, that runs directly in the face of a lot of this, we must reassure the allies talk in 2021. I mean, it just collides directly with that sort of liberal internationalist narrative, and Paul and I pointed it out.
It's an interesting lesson because it seems to me like the US is actually frequently bending over backwards for allies and partners. I don't think the US has fully grasped the leverage that it has in
That's right.
relationships with countries like Israel, Saudi Arabia, many European and Asian
Yeah.
allies. And we're always trying to, was it Schultz who called it gardening?
Yeah, that's right. I think we had that line in the paper, didn't we? Yeah.
Exactly, yes. So let's talk about sanctions. I
Sure.
know there is a certain there's that left side of South Korean politics that we talked about that favor loosening sanctions on North Korea.
Right.
And US sanctions have steadily increased and tightened on North Korea in recent years. And it certainly hasn't seemed to improve things. I think the scholarly literature on economic sanctions does not paint a very rosy picture of their effectiveness, and a lot of analysts suggest that sanctions make diplomacy harder. But you wrote a paper explicitly trying to make the case for these harsh sanctions. So first, if you can do me a favor and try to describe, give people a sense of what the sanctions are, what are the extent of them, what do they cover, you know, what's restricted, and then make the case that these are actually useful.
Okay. So initially, the sanctions were targeted on North Korean elites and elite transactions and stuff like that, and trying to go after elite lifestyles, right? So like one of the most controversial sanctions, one of the ones that the North Koreans want to get rid of, is the luxury ban, right? The luxury goods ban. By the way, there's a great deal of violation of this. When I flew into North Korea, I went to North Korea myself back in 2011, and you can like see people going from like Chinese, you go flying from Beijing, and you can see people going from like Chinese duty free, right, like right onto the plane in North Korea with like bags and bags of liquor and hair dryers, and so, and we're not, you know, that's not really working terribly well, I suppose. And so that was sort of the original idea. And then, I don't have the date exact in front of me. I want to say in like 2016, 2017, we stepped up to, that's all in the paper here. We stepped up to what they sometimes call sectoral sanctions, right? In which we started sort of blocking off entire chunks of the North Korean economy, right? So we made, for example, now it's like basically almost impossible to import metal in North Korea, right? And so like you get a lot of pushback from like NGOs and stuff like that saying, well, you know, we can't import medical equipment into North Korea unless we can import metal. And so it's like now it's like illegal to import like razor blades or paper clips into North Korea and stuff like that, right? And so there's been a big long debate about opt-outs and carve-outs and stuff like that. And some of that is covered in the KO paper. The sanctions have sort of, as you mentioned, they've sort of been increasingly ramped up. But there is an argument that previous to sectoral sanctions, I mean, I'm not so much the expert on this. Josh Stanton is really good on this. That actually, and Josh has sort of argued that before sectoral sanctions really started getting cranked up in the last 10 years, that North Korea is actually not nearly as heavily sanctioned as we think. That a lot of the sanctions are actually sort of more narrowly targeted, right? And they've only become sort of broader in the last, you know, 5 or 8 years. One of the other big things, sort of as a part of sort of the effort on sectoral sanctions, is to go after North Korean money, right? Which is start chasing North Korean money around, particularly in Chinese and Russian banks. There are limits to how much we can do that, though, because that creates tension with the Chinese and the Russian governments, whose elites are often sort of involved with the North Koreans in one way or another. And so, like, we start to expose the corruption in those two countries because of their deals with North Korea, which violate UN sanctions. Then that actually has larger costs for the relationship with both China and Russia. And so I think this is one reason why, like, the Obama administration, for example, ultimately sort of cuffed or sort of pulled back the Treasury Department, because they were worried that if we start sort of unveiling, you know, Chinese elites in bed with the North Koreans and stuff like that, it's going to embarrass all these figures in the Chinese government. It's going to start to sort of undercut wider Sino-US debates on things. So, I think those are the two sort of big sanctions, right? First, you had sort of the targeted sanctions that were really sort of looking at elites, and then you sort of gotten this wider, sort of increasingly economy-wide, sort of sectoral sanction effort to basically sort of block the North Koreans off from the entire global economy. Okay, right. So the argument for sanctions. I think part of the sort of idea about like sanctions is are they efficacious or not? I think part of it depends on like what you define as the goal. Right. And if you set up the goal to be, and here's where U.S. rhetoric has been really helpful, unhelpful. You know, when Trump went and met Kim Jong-un in North Korea met Kim Jong-un back in Singapore in 2018, right, the goal then was CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible disarmament. In other words, North Korea would like completely go to zero. That language has since been sort of reimagined as, I think, what fully FFVD, fully verifiable, something like that. Anyway, CVID. And that is basically saying the North Koreans have to give up everything, right? They have to get nukes, weapons, uranium mines, facilities, whole. I mean, that's just impossible, right? And so the North Koreans are never going to do that, right? So if you sort of what you're doing is you're kind of setting up sanctions to fail. If you insist that sanctions actually have to be, like, have to sort of, like, get North Korea to give up everything, right? I think the argument, that sort of the primary argument for sanctions, is to sort of squeeze North Korea so that it will eventually return to the negotiating table, and this gives us things to trade for it. In fact, I mean, if you look at the paper that I sort of argue, I actually make the argument at the end that sanctions should not be inviolable, right? We should, in fact, be willing to give them up if the North Koreans will make some trades and some concessions, right? I mean, ultimately, if we're going to get a deal with North Korea, we've got to be able to trade things away. And one of the things they really want is sanctions relief. And I'll be honest, I'm actually a little bit surprised that North Koreans have not been willing to deal more in order to get sanctions relief. But okay, a couple other things about sort of like why, sort of on sort of goals. I would argue that the goal of the sanctions really is to sort of like slow the North Korean march towards nuclear weapons, right? I mean, there's a whole sort of like literature on nuclear proliferation that argues that slowing down proliferation is a pretty good end in itself. And I think one of the things that sanctions did is help sort of retard this problem, and it allowed us to at least shuffle off to the future, kick the can down the road. Now we're coming to the end of that road. But I think for a while, the sanctions did buy us some time, right? They sort of retarded North Korea's ability to build these things and bought us some time. I quote a paper in the essay in which I sort of note that sort of if you look at like these projections for North Korea's nuclear futures and stuff like that, you know, there were analysts who were talking the North Koreans are going to have like 200 nuclear weapons by like, you know, like 2023 or something like that. I can't remember. It's in the paper. And it looks like the North Koreans have actually been kept to something like 40 or 50, right? And so there is some arguably counterfactual evidence that the sanctions have at least slowed the march, right? That the North Korean, the problem with North Korean nuclear weapons would be even worse if we didn't have the sanctions, right? So that, I think, is the strategic argument. So we're constricting North Korean economic growth in the strategic interest of South Korea and its partner states, right? In other words, the more North Korea grows, right, the more the North Korean economy functions, the more it's able to produce weapons, both conventional for the KPA and WMD as a part of the missile and the nuclear program, right? And so we're not going to get them to zero, right? So if you set up sanctions to mean we're going to get the CVID and it's going to be a failure, right? But we can, in fact, slow the march. And like I said, there is some, I don't know, data is not the right word. There's some sort of counterfactual logic, which I sort of go through in the paper, that suggests this might be the case, right? That there were sort of projections that the North Koreans were going to have like hundreds of nuclear weapons, and they don't seem to have that. And it seems like that might be because of sanctions. Again, this is all sort of thrashed out in the paper.
You also discuss that this is a useful way for the international community to express its kind of moral outrage at North Korea's totalitarianism, and that the regime is an outlier in the world and so on. And if the United States can lead the way in imposing sanctions, that expresses the international community's, this one I find a little tricky. I mean, you appeal to enforcing international law and expressing the international community's moral displeasure, but the international community is not really supposed to be in the business of punishing countries for their domestic governance structures. I think the UN Charter, which is the document that codifies the international community, really establishes that pretty unambiguously. That doesn't even get to the contradictory point, the hypocritical point. The United States has always buddied up to pretty vicious regimes, ones much like North Korea and ones much different, but vicious nonetheless. And so that undermines the legitimacy case, that these are legitimate to put on for some normative reason. I think when most people talk about sanctions in a strategic sense, it's can we pressure the other side to come our way in policy, just like you said, trade sanctions relief for something that the North Koreans want to give. And that's the logic that makes sense to apply. And that's the logic that I think the literature tends to use. And the literature always comes back, it seems to me, with a pretty dismal record. We never successfully incentivize, almost never, through sanctions alone, other countries to come our way, and especially not on major things like nukes, right? That's a major thing of national survival. I don't know. Many of the arguments for sanctions, I think, are pretty weak. And I think you framed the paper in this way, like there doesn't seem to be an intellectually coherent and scholarly defense of these sanctions. They're just a policy mess that hasn't helped the situation at all.
That's why I actually wrote the paper, because I was going to conferences for years during the Moon period where we were always hearing about how terrible the sanctions were. And you got kind of like lots of op-eds and articles here and there in like foreign policy or foreign affairs sort of making the bits and pieces of an argument for sanctions. So I tried to kind of draw that together. Sort of what are the kind of arguments that we hear for it, right? I mean, one of the most common argument, I think, actually, is the one that you sort of you were sort of criticizing, right? Which is that North Korea is sort of this like horrible Orwellian tyranny, and we should in some way respond to that. Right. I mean, human rights groups, I think I have some listings for that, right? I mean, human rights groups have repeatedly put North Korea at the bottom. I think Amnesty once put North Korea like below Talibanic Afghanistan or something like that, right? And so there, I think there's, you know, if you sort of, if you think that like Western, if you think that like the foreign policy preferences of the democratic community in the world, like the free world or whatever, should have some kind of moral content, right? Then North Korea is the place to start. Right, because North Korea is basically the floor for that, and that's sort of the, I think, if I recall, that's the argument that I made in the paper, right? That if you sort of, if you believe that, if you you know, without being like a neocon or something like that, you know, if you believe that U.S. foreign policy, if you believe that Western foreign policy, democratic foreign policy should sort of like concern itself with these kinds of issues at all, right? You know, North Korea is one of the very, very few, one of the countries where it's really hardest to overlook these kinds of things, right? I mean, if we're going to give up on North Korea, that means we're going to give up on the Uyghurs, we're going to give up on, you know, the repression in Myanmar and stuff like that. I mean, because North Korea really is sort of at the very bottom. But these are things that can sort of pop up all the time in Western and democratic foreign policy. We worry about these kinds of behaviors in states. And I would argue that North Korea is if we're going to talk about this in regard to any country at all, it should probably be North Korea, given just how really extreme it is.
With regard to regime type, there used to be an argument that was more prevalent about imposing sanctions, even up to a blockade, in the hopes that it would change the regime. And that clearly doesn't work. We think of Cuba, of course. We still are embargoing that country. And there's just not a slither of strategic substance to that policy at all. And I don't think there is much one with North Korea either. The people who say they're concerned on ethical grounds are also the people doing horrible things through U.S. foreign policy elsewhere. But also, you know, it actually does undermine the humanitarian health of the country to blockade it and to impose economic warfare on it. Your paper makes the case that North Korean regime is the one to blame. That's fine, and that's actually correct, but it's... Both things can be true. We can also make the humanitarian situation worse. And if we're targeting a people, an entire people in North Korea, to not have the benefit of global economic integration, I don't see the moral consistency whatsoever. But anyways.
Yeah, I mean, that's all in the paper. I mean, this territory is pretty well known at this point, right? I would argue that North Korea's own internal governance choices are vastly more important than what we do on the outside, right? I mean, if you want to argue that sort of like external assistance, aid, access to the world economy, you know, that we carry some kind of like moral burden for that, or, you know, if we cut it off, we carry like a moral burden for what happens inside North Korea, then you could make sort of the same argument about Soviet assistance in the 1990s, right, when the Russians cut that off, right, in like what, like 1995, right, when Yeltsin said we're not going to give the North Koreans friendship prizes anymore, right? I mean, that kind of helped push North Korea towards the famine, but nobody blames Moscow for the famine, right?
Well, no, I think a lot of people blame the United States for the famine that took place in Iraq in the 90s through the hefty.
Sure, sure. But if your argument is that foreigners have a substantial ability to impact the welfare of countries, right, then you know, in the North Korean case, you know, we're cutting them off from the world economy and stuff like that, and they can't import enough rice or whatever, right? Then that argument actually begins really with the Soviet Union and Russia in 1995, but nobody ever talks about that. And nobody blames Russia for the famine, but if your argument is that foreign imports, you know, are crucial for these countries, that are the difference between sort of life and death, then we should look at Russia. But nobody ever makes that argument. And I think it's because, honestly, I would argue because a lot of it's really politicized. The argument really is to try to get the Americans to show greater flexibility towards North Korea by pinning humanitarian consequences on Western behavior or sanctioned behavior that really I don't think can be, I don't think are really sustainable. I mean, I actually go through and I kind of Fisk line by line, not line by line, but sort of in some detail, a big sort of NGO paper in my paper making this argument. I've actually gotten into some debates with the authors on this question, right? But even they are willing, they're not actually able to fully argue that the impact is in fact really demonstrable, right? I mean, you have constrictions, but, you know, the issue is, I don't know how far you want to go down this rabbit hole, but, you know, North Koreans spend something like 25% of GDP on defense. And that's why they're starving. And that's why they're starving, right? Because the elite, you know, when they raise food in the villages, right? The local villagers don't get to keep it, right? They got to put it in a silo, which is leaky and old. So there's all this loss, right? And then the army shows up and just takes it. And then maybe later they get some of it back.
It seems to me the Biden administration has been very quiet and mum on peninsula politics in general. And I just kind of want to see if you have a sense of where things might be going. It, like you say, this is a persistently status quo kind of issue. It's a lot of political cost and effort to try and make any progress at all. And even then it might fail. So how do you see things going forward?
I think the Biden people saw the Trump people get burned, right? And, you know, we're like, we're not going to do that again. I think more generally, I think American administrations are increasingly like, you know, I don't want to wade into the North Korean morass. It's really, really difficult to untangle, right? The costs are high, the benefits are low, the possibility of a good sort of outcome is really far off. And I'm just not sure if I want to spend my capital doing that. You know, I mean, to a certain extent, I think this is also sort of the case in South Korea too, right? Where South Korea is just like, you know, it's just such a mess and we just don't want to go marching in there. And I think, you know, Biden is just distracted by all these other things, right? You know, COVID and inflation and you know, Donald Trump's supporters want to overthrow the government or whatever, and Ukraine and all this kind of stuff. I think Biden's just got a really full plate. And ultimately, you know, I mean, I would argue that, you know, no, ultimately North Korea is really South Korea's mess and South Korea should be taking the lead. I mean, one thing I liked about the Moon administration was that they were like, okay, we're going to like get out in front on this. I didn't really care for the policy direction, but I felt like the Moon administration was like, we're going to take ownership for this. Right. I mean, this is one reason why I kind of like Cato. I'm actually kind of a restrainer myself. I'd like to see the U.S. do less. So that's why one of the reasons why Paul and I wrote the piece. I would like to see the U.S. do less. I'd like to see U.S. allies do more. I'd like to see South Korea sort of take more control of its own foreign policy. This is why I don't really oppose South Korean nuclearization, because I'm like, you know, if they want to do it, if they feel like this is necessary for their security against China and North Korea, then let them make their own choices. We really shouldn't be pushing that on them. And I think, yeah, I think the Biden people, I think that, I mean, they're pretty traditional liberal internationalists. So I think they would actually like to be a little bit more involved in peninsular issues. I think it's really just a question of them just being overwhelmed. I think the Ukraine war is just sucking up all the bandwidth. Right. But my sense is that the Ukraine has just sort of absorbed everything. Right. And North Korea, it's always kind of the same. You know, the status quo, North Korea is not evolving. It's not changing. It's not getting any better. It's just the same sort of nasty Orwellian tyranny. It's kind of always been, and it's been nuked up for a while, and we've been learning to live with that for a while, you know, as we and I've discussed, right? I mean, we kind of say that we will never accept it, but we have in fact adjusted to that. And so North Korea is a problem that can just be put on the back burner. I would, you know, there's now a South Korean conservative president. I would like to see the South Korean right sort of step up and take this on and think about what to do instead of sort of looking for us so much. I see these op-eds that show up in Korean media every month or something like that, you know, like, where are the Americans on South Korea and on North Korea? And always kind of like, well, you know, what are you guys going to do? Right. I mean, I would like to see us sort of behind the South Koreans, kind of following their lead and not restricting their range of motion too much. I mean, this is one of the things that happened with Moon, right? I mean, Moon started veering so much that he started colliding with the Americans. But in principle, I think we should give the South Koreans a lot of space to try to figure out how they want to deal with North Korea. And the Moon government, the current government, I think, is less willing to do that. I think they really want to sort of get the Americans involved because they're really concerned that the Moon government put a lot of stress on the American alliance. And that's how they really want to sort of revive that. I think that's why President Yoon went to NATO, for example, you know, a couple months ago, because they really want to sort of impress the Americans, like, you know, we're working together. And, you know, Yoon's article in Foreign Affairs when he ran for the presidency was literally like, South Korea must step up. And he literally was like saying the kinds of things that American hawks want to hear. And that was explicitly designed to sort of outreach for the United States. And so, you know, we're not going anywhere, you know, the U.S., and we're going to be here for a while. We kind of lead policy a little bit, maybe more than we should. But, you know, I mean, we don't really have any good ideas about what to do about North Korea. Right. I mean, we've been talking about this problem for 30 years, North Korean nuclear weapons. I mean, nobody really knows how to fix it. Right. If they did, it would have been tried. So again, the status quo is just sort of here and durable. So, you know, we'll be talking about this in a decade.
Robert E. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.